Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I'm your host Shane Lees, and joining me this week I've got Harry Philby.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. How are you doing, listeners? Good to know, good to know.
From Mo Salah, who gets in on the act. It's surely Liverpool's day now.
Barnes. Oh, that's spectacular!
Eriksen tries again. Oh, that's phenomenal! Absolutely phenomenal!
Manchester City champions, and it's been decided in their favour.
Right, we are going to start off with the news. A bit of a strange one this week. Paul Gascoigne has had his nomination to be put in the Scottish Hall of Fame withdrawn after there were criticisms. Now, it initially started off, there was criticisms about his previous racism, domestic abuse, and general questionable antics, and that was the cause for concern. But then afterwards, it was like, no, it's actually about his health. We don't think this would be good for him at the moment with his health. I find this a really, really strange one, because if we're talking about poor behaviour in general, I think if you're going back to historic players, they'd probably have had to eliminate a few players who've ended up in the Hall of Fame. And that would be for every FA in the world. They'd probably have to go back and eliminate some players who are, you know, awful womanizers or generally quite racist or just kind of terrible people with amazing footballers. And if it's to do with his health, isn't that... I mean, I know he's obviously not got the best track record of self-discipline, but isn't that his decision?
Yeah, exactly. And in that case, do we deny the same things for like Maradona or someone like that? You know, it's for me, that seems like a bit of a cop out that they would just say, oh, it's because of his health. It's like, well, is it really?
Yeah. And I can't help but wonder, and I haven't done enough research to find out how many players are on the Scottish Hall of Fame. I can't help but wonder if they would have even had this debate if he was Scottish.
It is interesting. That seems weird. I don't know. Why would he be in the Scotland Hall of Fame anyway? Because of his time at Rangers?
Yes, because at Rangers, obviously, I think he put in about 100 appearances for Rangers.
Yeah.
Was quite instrumental to one of their title wins. And there are other people who are not just Scottish in the Hall of Fame. I know Brian Laudrup's in there. I'm pretty sure Henrik Larsson's in there as well.
Oh, right. Okay. So it's tributes to Scottish football as opposed to Scottish footballers.
Yeah, it's to great names in Scottish football. Mm. And I can understand in some ways why they would want to not put Paul Gascoigne in there. But at the same time, if he was nominated, and he was nominated by the members on the basis of his contributions to Scottish football, shouldn't the whole thing rise and fall on that? Because, I mean, if you go back through the list of people, Graham Souness has done some deeply questionable stuff. People forget about some of Souness's things he's done. Dennis Law, another one. There's some questionable stuff behind some of these people. I'm not saying, you know, they're questionable people or anything, but also wouldn't say Gaz is a questionable person. He's clearly someone who just came up from a very, very different kind of background to what we are used to in football. He was not a, media-trained kind of person. He was working for us for injury. He came up in that way. You can't help the way you're brought up. You can't help the way you're raised. And if you're raised in a racist environment, you're probably going to end up being racist. That's just how that kind of works. Mm. So I don't think you can condemn people for that kind of thing, because also at the same time, every time he's had an opportunity to say something about this stuff, he always feels terrible about it, quite clearly. So it's as a case of as he got older, he sort of learned a little bit more about these things. I always feel like that's punishing someone for just not being the ideal. But isn't the whole point of being in a football Hall of Fame meant to be about football, not the rest of it?
Yeah, and I don't really understand how putting him in the Scottish Hall of Fame would be bad on his health at the moment. Like, surely, you know, it just seems a bit weird to me that they would come up with that excuse as to why it was because of his health. It seems like they probably just backed out of it because some people complained, probably.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, and to be honest, if you're going to have something like this, just don't leave it open to the public getting to choose. Yeah. Just have some people in the back room somewhere deciding it, because if you let the public suddenly start choosing that thing, what happens if they suggest something that you fundamentally disagree with?
Yeah.
You've got to come up with some crap reason like this one, and it just doesn't quite fly. The whole thing seems a bit odd. All right, Eden Hazard, he's been making quite a lot of noise these last few weeks about wanting to play for Real Madrid. Now, he's openly said that playing for Real Madrid has been his dream since he was a kid. This wasn't put out there on Instagram or Twitter or anything like that. It's something he said openly in a press conference. He said that he might need to go to Spain to go and win the Ballon d'Or, that he's always wanted to play for Real Madrid. He's been totally open about it. He said he's not going to move there in January. He wants to stick with Chelsea for the time being. But he's been open that that's something he's always wanted to do. Is this actually refreshing, or is this something you think a player should never openly say that?
No, I think this is really, really, really refreshing. I think it's really nice to, because he's always been a very calm, relaxed player. We get so often, we get all these horrible stories about things leaking out, whether players aren't quite happy so-and-so places, and he's just been totally honest about it and said, look, I'm still a Chelsea player, and I will be until at the very least the end of this year, and I've given you 6 or 7 years of what has been one of the best players in the Premier League all the time, and I think I deserve a chance to go and play for Real Madrid, but I won't let it compromise Chelsea, which I think is a lot nicer, because it's a lot better than when you got like with Virgil van Dijk at Southampton, where it was everyone knew he wanted to go play anyway. But because of the attitude the club had towards him, the way he behaved and the way he actually behaved, it ends up spoiling a season, and he sits in the reserves and all this kind of stuff.
And I think with behind the scenes, the players at the club, the board, the managers, they'll always know when a player wants to leave, because he'll tell them, I want to leave. I hear there's an offer coming in, or I hear this club wants to buy me. I want to go. There's a bid. You accept that, please. So they'll know. The only people who don't really know is the fans. They don't probably know. It's all just rumour and speculation. So why not just tell the fans? If it's all going to come out anyway, if it's all being subtly leaked here or there, fans know about it anyway, and it just breeds resentment because it's all seen as being kept secretive. Either breeds resentment of the club for keeping this from the fans, or breeds resentment of the player, which prevents players being looked at in sort of legacy as being great players for the club. If it's a sour ending, you can't look at that player as being a great player for them. That was something we were a lot better at quite a few years ago, understanding that players just move on and we don't have to hate them the second they've gone. Yeah. As I know I'm pretty guilty about being a Samson fan, but Christ, it's all just been pure animosity with every single one of our players who leaves, other than maybe Callum Chambers.
Yeah.
But I think as well, there's a direct comparison with this, and that's Paul Pogba. Clearly wants to go to Barcelona. He's taking every press conference opportunity and every chance in social media have little digs, little pops to say, oh, I can't talk about that. I would get fined if I said what I mean. That's him saying I want to leave, but not saying it.
Yeah, I think there is a difference because obviously like Chelsea are performing a lot better, and Hazard thinks that he's probably going to have his best season at Chelsea now because of Sarri and all that kind of stuff. And he even said if Conte was here, I wouldn't be and all this kind of stuff. So I think it has a lot to do, like the difference between Hazard and Pogba is that Pogba's having a nightmare and Hazard's having a great time at Chelsea. And if Pogba was playing really well at United and really enjoying it, I don't think he necessarily harbours any real passion to go to Barcelona other than getting out with Man United. Like really, I think if he wanted to, he would rather Man United were playing well than he had to go to Barca. Yeah, I think it's really nice, to be honest. I've always hated the way that clubs try to sort of lie to their fans about the situation of players, like saying, oh yeah, so-and-so doesn't want to leave, doesn't want to do this, and 2 weeks later they sign a contract to somebody else. I think it's the other person who could do it is somebody like Aaron Ramsey. Like, Ramsey sort of denied this contract and said, if Arsenal really want to keep me, we need to see improvements. And that's basically what Hazard's doing, is saying, you know, if there is a way you can keep me, but if not, I'm probably going to go to Real Madrid, and that's fine, you know.
The best example I can think of is Adam Lallana at Southampton. We knew he wanted to go. He was making noises. He was telling the board. He was refusing to play. That was how bad it got. Yeah. The board was saying, no, Adam Lallana, he's our captain. He's going to be here for years to come. Then he's getting sold to Liverpool.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that all before that Lallana was, you know, fumbling the badge, kissing the badge and saying that it was his dream to be the next Letizier, you know, the one club player for Southampton. That doesn't help when the second you actually finally get an offer, you refuse to play for that team.
Yeah,
but the whole way that thing went out, there was no way that Southampton fans could really be positive about it. There's no way, even when you get the money, even if you get ridiculous money, you can't be positive about it. Because you're left hating a player that you were cheering for, and you never want to be in that position. But yeah, if players are going to leave and players will transfer to other clubs, it's an inevitability. I prefer the whole thing is just upfront and fairly honest throughout.
Yeah,
that's a much better process of doing things rather than keeping it secret. We are going to talk now about Wembley. Wembley is in discussions to be sold by the FA to, and forgive me if I completely mispronounce this, Shahid Khan. Now, he is the owner of Fulham. He's also the owner of, I think it's the Jacksonville Jaguars, an NFL team in America. Billionaire, he's got a whole bunch of money, and he's offered £600 million to buy Wembley Stadium. And there's a few things which aren't included in that deal, things such as the hospitality package at Wembley, which I don't believe is for sale. And it also, the deal would still include that all England games are played at Wembley. there are senior FA executives, so the people who are actually running Football Association, have had a meeting with the FA Council, which is made up of a lot of councillors and a lot of people who are genuinely quite involved in football. It's 127 members of that council. They've said they've had a very healthy discussion about the sale of the stadium, but they've also admitted there's a hell of a lot more resistance than they thought there was going to be. Now, there's plenty of people who are in favour of it, and their belief is that with £600 million, that's more investment they're going to get in many years for grassroots football. And they can go ahead and spend that money on grassroots football, really bring it up without actually losing England Stadium. Now, the other side of it is people saying, for one thing, you can't sell our national stadium. That is just an absolute outrage, especially the money that was spent on it in the first place, sacrifice that was involved in building that stadium, and the fact that we've completely segregated the rest of the country away from England football. England football doesn't go on tour anymore. It's all based in London. But also turning around then and saying, all right, £600 million, that sounds great. That would be a really good investment into grassroots football. Of course, the FA's track record of spending money isn't actually that good. Yeah. So maybe it's not even going to be worth it. Maybe we get £600 million and it gets pissed away. They're saying it's not worth the risk of doing this. We lose something that we can never get back, and the money, we have no idea that it'll ever be put to good use. Combine that with the fact that we're going to be going through Brexit very soon. We have no idea what that's going to do to the pound or the dollar. We have no idea how this transfer is going to happen in terms of monetary funds. That money could be worth 10% less within a week. So that's £600 million. You'd instantly lose £60 million worth of value. And that's when you talk about that kind of scale of money, that's what you've got to start thinking about. That's what you've got to start considering. The timing is off as well. Because if you're going to do something like this, you need to do it during a period of complete stability. So the money, it's set. You can actually spend that money in the exact worth it is. I have talked on this podcast before. I am totally opposed to this. Completely opposed to this because, in my view, you should not sell your national stadium. We sell enough things in Britain to foreign ownership. Okay, we need to actually own some things in our country because otherwise all we're owning is various stuff in China. And the Chinese own more of our stuff anyway, so that's not really going to get us anywhere. But also, I agree completely. £600 million of the FA. When haven't the FA buggered anything up? When was the last time they did something that was genuinely quite good for English football, apart from go for Gareth Southgate, because there was literally not a single other person we could have hired? I genuinely can't, especially when it comes to funding. Because as we know, they are, well, they're just like Parliament, local council, all of that lot. Where the money goes in one place, and then this big chunk of money just sort of goes missing, spent on things like admin, wages and salaries for the people involved in the FA.
And corruption.
Well, white paper corruption. You know, the corruption is totally illegal. You know, you've got brand managers at the FA who are earning like £80,000 a year. And that's a fact. I know that because I'm in recruitment. I've seen these people, right? So yeah, that's £80,000, you know, a year is going on these kinds of people. That there's this big chunk of this £600 million, which will just never get down to the grassroots level. It's a bit like donating to a charity. If you donate to a charity, you want to know that the most amount of money possible going to where it's actually supposed to go. So you don't donate to a charity where you know that actually a lot of those people are just spending that money on flights and hiring people and more campaigns, and it's all just going in a bit of a circle. It's not really going to the people who need it. And it's the same exact thing with the FA, because this is, of course, not a for-profit organisation. So people are looking at about £600 million going, where's that going to go? Where's that going to end up? Is that going to end up where we need it to? And the fact is, if they're working with local councils to build pitches, if they're working with local councils to get more coaches, and all of a sudden that council decides, we want to have developers on that land. That's £600 million that's gone. The money they spent on that is gone. It's not going to be a case of, oh, and we'll have to replace that with another one, because that needs new money. You don't get a refund from the council when you've done that. So, and it's because there are these differences between what the FA think they can do and what the councils know they actually can do, we suddenly have this massive imbalance of where that £600 million goes. I could be okay with this deal if I knew that it was going to make a significant improvement to English football. But I don't see that it's going to happen. I don't realistically see that it's going to make any kind of real impact. It should do, but in reality, I just think it won't, which is what we've got to live in. Reality, not a hopeful world of isn't this a lot of money. What do you think, Harry? I'll talk for a little bit.
Yeah. No, I agree. To be honest, I can never really understand the FA stuff. I don't really know enough about the FA and, you know, their past and their history and the way they run and anything like that to say. But I don't mind them renting it out to Tottenham for a couple of years, because there's always an intention that they're going to move to their new stadium. That was the whole point. It's a stopgap, and it gives them a little bit of money to put into Wembley, so it's not just sitting there for a few years. But like, I don't know, man. I just don't want it to be. I don't like the idea of our national stadium being owned by a Premier League football team, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the plus side is that the FA executives have said that they'd like to see a kind of like a super majority, a clear mandate from their council to go and put this through. So they're looking for upwards of 60% of the council to go and approve it. They currently don't think they're going to get that. But also, we should mention that the FA Council has no binding way to say that this shouldn't happen. So even if 70, 80% of them said no, the FA executives, we already know they're in favour of this. So the people who have actually got the decision, they're already in favour of this. The only thing that could really derail them is if they see a clear move from everyone else within the Football Association, as well as the public, to say, no, this is a terrible idea. And we know the public hate it. We know that people in football hate it. And we know that the council is generally not in favour of it. Yet the fact that they're still having these conversations, for me, it just makes me think they're going to do it anyway. Because otherwise, wouldn't they have turned around by this point and gone, yeah, clearly everyone hates this. This is clearly not a good idea in the eyes of the British public as well as the actual people involved in football, so let's probably not do this. I mean, the fact they're even having this conversation with the FA Council is kind of proof that they're planning on doing it anyway. I think this is a bit of an inevitability, and it will render nothing good. That's my view.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
Sticking with England, we're going to be playing Croatia behind closed doors. Now, I tell you what,
You mean Lewis Dunk's going to be playing Croatia?
Yeah, we'll talk about Lewis Dunk in a minute. I quite like when you watch the games played behind closed doors on TV, mainly because you can hear what every single player is saying.
Yeah.
And I quite like having that insight into how like proper professional level footballers communicate. Yeah. Obviously, we are not going to know that with the Croatian players because they are going to be speaking Croatian. So we're going to hear the likes of Harry Maguire and all of that shouting at each other, which would be quite fun. But on a more serious note, why this has happened, why it's being played behind closed doors is because, Croatian fans have a track record of doing some pretty nasty things, including chemically spraying a swastika on, I think it was the Zagreb pitch for a Croatia game. So it's visible during the actual game. Obviously, that's not a very good thing. They got punished for that with I think it's two or three games behind closed doors. This is one of them. But England fans didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything. We didn't paint any swastikas. We didn't abuse anyone racially. We didn't do anything wrong. Why are we being punished? Surely it should just be Croatian fans aren't allowed in because everyone's did something wrong. Why wouldn't more of a punishment be you're at a disadvantage, Croatia, because England have got their fans in the stadium, but you don't have any of yours. They've got all the backing here. Wouldn't that be a proper punishment?
Ideally, yes, but I think it's just way too impractical to enforce that because if they were like, oh yeah, the England fans can go and the Croatian fans won't, there would definitely be riots outside the stadium. Like there would definitely be a bunch of Croatia fans showing up to contest it. And if you said only one group of fans could come or whatever, but I do agree, it's harsh that England fans aren't able to go.
An alternative point of view: take the game away from Croatia. Say, right, you've lost your home game. This is being played in England now. Wouldn't that be a better solution? Because people are saying, right, you're punishing the association by not letting them have revenue from the matches. To be honest, a lot of these things are predetermined anyway. They get set revenues because things like TV revenue. They're still going to get TV revenue for this because it's being broadcast live around the world. So that isn't too much of a punishment. And you're punishing, like, for instance, with the Croatian fans, it would have been a handful of fans who did these things. Majority of those fans are going to be like the fans we saw at the World Cup. Good, yeah. Passionate fans. Love their team, love football, and are just generally quite nice people. They're the ones who get punished because they're the 98% of the fans who go to these games. The England fans didn't do anything wrong, and 100% of them get punished for this. And nobody really loses anything. Because you can turn around and say, oh, our team's going to play worse, but wouldn't the away team also play worse if they don't have their fans there? Doesn't it not really impact anything? So shouldn't there be an actual qualitative punishment? As in, you can say this is genuinely a punishment, such as losing your away game, or losing your home game, sorry, or having only the opposition's fans being there.
How long ago were they given the ban?
It was before the World Cup.
Okay. So there would have been enough time to organise it into putting it into the UK. Yeah, I think that would have made sense. I'm trying to think of any reason why they wouldn't have considered that. And it's probably just to maybe consider it unfair on the players. But like you said, it's already unfair on the players to lose their home support and all this kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, you've got to say it's a punishment one way or the other, so actually follow through with it. I feel like the played behind closed doors is such a limp-wristed thing. It's such a, here's a little slap for you. You did a bad thing. No, slap them on the arse and do it hard. Get it done with. Jesus. I did not go to public school, by the way, if he's wondering. Stay, come on. Right, okay. With that game, though, how do you think we're going to do? It's a very much reduced England team. Danny Rose has dropped out. McCarthy's dropped out as well. Obviously, he's not going to be playing. But it's not exactly... We've given it a lot of praise for being a young England team, and I certainly am full of praise for it being that. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a competitive England team. And we're going up against two of the best teams in the world, and both of them are away games.
Yeah, but Lewis Dunk's there, and he's going to get man of the match in both the games and be nailed on star in the Euros. So
probably not going to play.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. He's there, you know. It's fun. Man, I'm really excited about that. But, I think, to be honest, we said it before the other week, that I think the best thing that can come out of these games, obviously other than winning and playing well, is a lot of the players are getting bought in, performing well. Like, I do think Maddison should play. Like, it would annoy me if he didn't get minutes. Honestly, I think he should play 90 minutes of both the games. It's been made clear to us, especially towards the back end of the World Cup, that we are not good from open play. There is no other way to put it. We don't create enough chances. Sure, we can either drill it into the starting team, like new ideas and new tactics. That's fine on its own. But new players is just as important for me. So I would be well in favour of, like, especially stuff like, I would like Trent Alexander-Arnold to get a run out because he's been playing better than Trippier so far this season. Was it Ben Chilwell who got called up to replace Danny Rose?
Chilwell got called up to replace Luke Shaw.
Actually. Oh, okay. Okay. Who have we got? Who's going to start at left back then?
I think Chilwell is the only actual left back we have. I don't know if we called up Fabian Delph.
He hasn't been playing Delph, so it would surprise me.
No.
If he did.
It's strange that we actually have another left back who's playing rather well.
Oh, except for Ryan Bertrand.
Oh, that's right, Ryan Bertrand. That would have been a strange thing to do, to call up someone who's consistently fit and plays well pretty much every single season. What an odd thing that would have been.
Yeah, that baffles me so much.
Yeah, I'm pleased that Chilwell has been called up. He's a promising player, and from everything I've seen of him, he does seem like a fairly nice bloke. Still can't understand it. With both of our left backs dropping out. Man, call up Bertrand.
Yeah,
what are you doing, man? Alright, predictions for the two games.
Croatia, I think, will draw 1-1. I think it'll be an edgy, awkward, difficult game.
A bad game is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically. Like, no other way of saying it.
Spain, England?
Oh, we're going to get battered. ripped apart, I reckon. We'll be shown how to actually play football from open play and get ripped to shreds, I reckon, probably. 3-0 Spain.
3-0. Yeah, my prediction is 2-0 Croatia. Sorry, England. I'm just not confident at all. And I was actually thinking 4-0 Spain. Spain are actually looking okay at the moment. So
they were I think Paco Alcacer has just scored a hat-trick against Wales.
I didn't even see that. Well, you can now tell what time we are recording the podcast, listeners.
Yeah,
we drop all sorts of little hints in here.
Oh, no, Alcacer's on a hat-trick. There is half-time and they're 3-0 up against Wales.
Wales are not bad. Okay.
Yeah, they're quite good at football, Spain.
Maybe more than 4-0. All right, moving on. I know this is something you want to talk about quite a lot, Harry. We're going to talk about the Ballon d'Or nominations.
Hey, it's a joke.
Well, we've avoided swearing in the entire podcast right up until that moment. Thank God we're not on YouTube, boys, or we'd have been demonetized.
I'll beat that out.
I'm
going to beat that one.
Okay, right. Why is it a joke?
Because there's just so many players who deserve to be there and aren't there, and so many players who don't deserve to be there who are. It's ridiculous.
Right, let's start with the players who don't deserve to be there.
What is Karim Benzema doing there? What is he doing? The only conceivable reason I can think of is that they're like, oh, he was playing up front, I'm doing my quotation fingers, for a Champions League winning side. That's literally the only reason I can think they could do it. They would do it. He was not outstanding last season. He's had much better years. I find it absolutely mental that David Silva's not in there and Karim Benzema is. I have no idea how De Gea's not in there. It's the main problem with it is it's so difficult to judge it because it's done by calendar years, when really it should be done by seasons. Because then what happens is players benefit from having consistent teams and consistent managers over the course of the what essentially becomes two half seasons. Because even like somebody like Hazard, even if you were basing it on last season's performance, he would be up there. But I don't think he would be, you know, I think there would be other players that could compete with him because, you know, he didn't have the best of seasons last year. But the way he started this year and the way he's gone in the World Cup makes him pretty much a no-brainer. And I just find it, I just think there's so many players that, and it's like, I don't know why Mandzukic is in there. That can only be from the World Cup, because I don't think he was very extraordinary for Juventus last season. I want to say he only got like 5 or 6 goals, but I think he was playing out wide.
Yeah, I think as well. I think Mandzukic and Ronaldo are the only players from Italy. And obviously Ronaldo's not being nominated for his achievements in Italy. Yeah. I think that was probably a little bit of a hat tip to we've not included a single player from this entire country, which is supposedly one of the best footballing nations in the world.
Yeah. So put Dybala in there. Like, that's the thing. Or put Chiellini or Bonucci or somebody like that. Oh, Bonucci had a bad year, to be fair. Just somebody like that makes much more sense to me than Mandzukic. He wasn't the defining player for Juventus last season. And, like, the truth is most of them are pretty okay. And I'm saying it's pretty okay is reasonable when there are really only 3 or 4 players who have even a chance of winning it. And Messi should win it. But Modric, I think, probably will.
Yeah, I mean, do you know one player I can't understand why he's in there? Alisson.
Yeah, that's another one. Like for me, Alisson.
Perfectly good goalkeeper.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I know Lloris won the World Cup and everything, but he didn't have a good season for Spurs last year, and he's barely played at the start of this year.
Wouldn't you have said Ederson, who actually won a title?
Mm.
Or would De Gea. Would be a better competitor for that one.
Yeah, or De Gea, who had the single best season of Premier League football goalkeepers ever seen in the Premier League. You know, yeah, I think it's ridiculous.
It's a strange one. What's also a strange one is you've got 2 Man City players on that entire list. You've got 1 Man United player and 2 Chelsea players, I think.
Yeah.
Kante and Hazard. It's almost, you know, I think people forgot that Man City may have had the best Premier League season in all of history.
Yeah, like I think Sterling and Silva should be nailed on in there. Nailed on. Silva in particular, because people would disagree with me all they want, but I've always said that Silva's better than De Bruyne now. At the moment, I would take David Silva's performances for a season over De Bruyne's. I just think he's a better player all round, despite De Bruyne being amazing, probably going to pass that at some point. But like, and Roberto Firmino's in there as well, and I love Roberto Firmino, but Sterling was better than Firmino last season. So was, again, Silva. I just think there's so many weird choices. Paul Pogba's in there. That can only be because of the World Cup.
Yeah, it doesn't make too much sense. I mean, this one is decided exclusively by France Football. It's decided by journalists. So there are, of course, going to be biases in there. There's going to be political considerations for these kinds of things. But one thing that I am pleased about is that the public don't get to vote on this. Sorry, democracy. But they did a poll, I think. It's in a French newspaper. I don't know if it was France Football. I haven't double-checked this. I do know the stats behind it. They did a poll saying who should win the Ballon d'Or. And I think 28 of the players got less than 8% of the votes.
Okay.
Mohamed Salah got 42% of the votes and Messi got 50%.
Because he should. Messi should win it. He's like, does that mean Cristiano Ronaldo got less than 8%?
Yes.
Yeah.
28, all the other 28 players got less than 8%.
That's my favourite poll ever.
but I mean, didn't Luka Modric have a pretty good year?
Yeah, that's true. That's harsh. Like the thing is we spoke about this when the FIFA World Player of the Year, whatever they call it, was announced, and it was Modric. Is basically, if you're not giving it to Modric as essentially the Lifetime Achievement Award, and you're genuinely going to give it to the best player of last year, then you give it to Messi. He was the best player. Like, it doesn't matter. You don't think Messi was the best player?
Last year, no. Modric was.
No. See, Modric has had better years, I think. Modric was brilliant this year, don't get me wrong, but I would rather have Messi than Modric, is the truth. And that if you're basing it on the best player of last year, I would give it to Messi.
Yeah, the best player of last year, and who had a better year last year than Modric?
Messi?
No, he didn't. He in the World Cup. He was crap.
Modric took
an underdog Croatia side to the final. He won the Champions League with Real Madrid. All Messi did was win the league with Spain. Barcelona.
Get a stupid amount. Didn't he lead the league on goals and assists?
Oh, then maybe Salah should be up. Maybe Salah then. Or maybe, I don't know, Aguero. Because he won the league with Man City. Or Silva. Or De Bruyne. Because they're on the same. Messi, last year, they're on the same page as what Messi's on.
Because Messi's better than them. Messi is. He just is.
It's nothing to do with the player's better. The player being better than another player has nothing to do with who should win the Ballon d'Or. If Jamie Vardy scored 80 goals in the league and won the World Cup for England, it wouldn't matter that he's a bit crap, because he was better in the year than Lionel Messi. We know that Messi's better. We know that Ronaldo's better. I mean, we know that maybe Keita's better than Jamie Vardy, but we'd still have to say Vardy was the best player of that year.
I'd still pick Messi. Messi was still the best player last year.
Scored 80 goals and won the World Cup.
Oh, yeah. If Vardy scored 80 goals, yeah, sure. Why not? But
right, so you're saying it's the best player of that year, the best player in that year.
I still think Messi was the best player last year. He was just went... Like, it sounds a bit stupid, but I think there were... Because of the World Cup, people thought Messi had a bad year. He didn't. He was incredible.
I'm not saying he had a bad year. I'm not saying, oh, Messi's rubbish now.
Yeah.
But also, you were the person who didn't argue, not for a moment, that Modric shouldn't have won the FIFA Player of the Year.
Well, I preferred Modric winning it to who I thought was going to win it, which was I thought they were going to give it to Ronaldo.
So you thought Messi should have won it?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I still think... yeah.
Your confidence levels have dipped sharply.
Hey, I'm back. No. See, my point of view is Messi... I still think Messi was the best player last year. If I could have picked one player to put into my team performances based on last year, I would still pick Messi. That's as simple as me. I'd be fine with Modric winning it. That's absolutely fine. And honestly, like we've already said before, it's really hard to gauge these kind of things because the best player on their own is such a hard thing to judge. But like really, it's between Modric, Messi, Ronaldo, Salah, maybe, but I don't think he'll really win it. And genuinely Mbappe. Mbappe's in with a shout. And Kante, because I thought Kante was the best midfielder next to Modric.
Do you know who I really hope wins it?
Philbert Courtois.
Jan or Black.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
On this poll, this was done on France Football, by the way. Do you want to know who got 0%?
Who got 0%?
Isco, Harry Kane, N'Golo Kante, Hugo Lloris, Mario Mandzukic, Sadio Mane, Marcelo, Sergio Ramos, Luis Suarez, Paul Pogba, Jan Oblak, Sergio Aguero, Alisson, Gareth Bale, Karim Benzema, Edison Cavani, Courtois, De Bruyne, Firmino and Godin. All of those players got 0%. I mean,
that is a few players.
France football, I'm presuming this is mostly being voted on by French people. Did you forget that you guys won a World Cup?
Yeah.
Shouldn't you be voting for the French guys?
Blimey, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, never doubt how popular Salah and Messi are.
Yeah, so that's Salah is the Egyptian king though, so that'll do for him.
Deary me. I don't think this should go to Messi. I definitely don't think this should go to Ronaldo.
No.
I do think Luka Modric had the best year of a footballer last year. He did in midfield what is the equivalent of Messi scoring all those goals. Because a midfielder cannot score those goals. It's not going to happen. Yeah. Same way a defender can't score those goals. They can have as good a year, be as good a player.
The argument is also, like we said, I don't really mind them giving it to him as kind of like the lifetime achievement thing, but I genuinely don't think Modric played better this year than he did the last 2 years. Last 2 years, he was undeniably the best central midfielder in the world. With him and Kroos were undeniably the best two central midfielders as a partnership. And now this year, he obviously had a great year, but
I don't think Modric necessarily got any better. I think his performances for the clubs happened in bigger moments, which obviously added to more. I also think Messi and Ronaldo dipped. And you could say, oh, no, Messi was still a great player. Yeah, of course he was still a great player. Not in the big moments, not in the moments that mattered.
Didn't he top the league on goals and assists, though?
Yeah, he did it for the league. So what? At the same point, why wouldn't you say Salah? Oh, he was definitely amazing. Wouldn't you say Salah is right up there in the same way as Messi? Because, yes, Messi obviously won the league with Barcelona and Salah didn't with Liverpool. Then wouldn't you say someone like Aguero or Kevin De Bruyne, who had an absolutely outstanding year for Man City, or Sterling, who for a midfielder... But what was it? It was close to 20 goals or something ridiculous.
Well, Sterling basically, I think, got 16 goals and 12 assists or something like that, which is elite level numbers. That's elite level numbers.
Absurd. So those players had almost as good a numbers as Messi, achieved the same amount, although they actually achieved more in the sense of the best Premier League season of all time. But let's compare it to what was actually accomplished alongside those performances. It's Modric.
I mean, if we were building a Ballon d'Or 11, my front three would probably be Messi, Salah, and probably Mbappe, I think. That would be my front three.
Yeah, I think the only other player you could possibly say, based on accomplishment, in a weird way, would be Raphael Varane.
Oh, yeah.
Varane won the Champions League and was outstanding in the year.
Yeah, Varane, without a doubt, is the best defender on that list in terms of, like, because it also factors, like, I don't think it should, but if you were thinking from the Ballon d'Or sense of the most iconic moments of the year, Varane was involved in absolutely everything interesting that happened this year with, like, Real Madrid winning the Champions League and winning the World Cup, and he was brilliant in the World Cup. Like, I would pick Varane as the number one defender if I was given a choice.
There is some justice in that poll. He got a solid 1%.
Is there? Oh, okay. That was me. Yeah. I mean,
Griezmann as well got 1%.
And you said Kante got 0.
Kante got 0.
All right. I just find it's more annoys me, the players. Like, I'm seriously struggling to understand how David Silva's not in the list. Like, I really don't. I thought Silva was... I still think Silva is a better player than De Bruyne. I would rather have him.
Not in there, but Sadio Mane is.
What? I didn't even notice him there. What?
Yeah. Not Silva, but Mane. All the things he did with Senegal.
Well, and...
And all the accomplishments Liverpool made.
Yeah, and Sterling should have been. Their argument is probably... he played well in the Champions League by scoring a hat-trick against... like a no-name club who I can't even remember. So, yeah. Like, most of them in there deserve it, but there's five or six players I would take out for five or six other players, like De Gea, Silva, Sterling. I would probably put in for Mane, Mandzukic, and probably Firmino.
And, of course, Kieran Trippier.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
We need him. I've got to be honest. Football awards now, I look at them in the same way as Oscars, as in utterly meaningless, apart from for the backslapping for the people involved.
Yeah,
it's just, it doesn't mean anything. There's no significance anymore. Just stop paying attention to them. Eventually they'll realise they have to start making sense.
Yeah.
All right. But one other thing I want to talk about, this follows on perfectly from Ballon d'Or, talking about world-class footballers. Bournemouth. Yeah, sorry, Bournemouth fans. You know I'm being sarcastic there. But in all seriousness, I said it was going to be either us or Bournemouth to finish 19th.
Mm-hmm.
Bournemouth are sixth in the league.
Yeah.
They've won five, lost only two, and drawn one. They've scored, what's it, something like a pretty decent amount of goals. I think it's like 16 goals they've scored.
Yeah, I want to say they are pulling like tops. They're pulling like top four numbers.
I'm pretty sure they've conceded as many as sort of most other teams. But they're scoring for fun. I mean, Callum Wilson's been involved in, what is it, something like 4 goals and 3 assists?
Yeah.
And Ryan Fraser's got something really similar. It's amazing stats from Bournemouth. And that's kind of gone under the radar a little bit, which is surprising, because everyone's always just rushing to rim Eddie Howe.
Yeah, they've scored 16, conceded 12. And to put that into perspective, Liverpool have scored 15.
And everyone talks about still how amazing the Liverpool attack is.
Yeah.
And Ryan Fraser and Callum Wilson are outscoring them.
Yeah, I mean, I still think the issue is they tend to absolutely fall off a cliff in the last 10-15 games of the season unless they really need to be good. Like, I still don't expect anything more than mid-table for them. 10th is a good target for them.
You say you don't expect them to do anything more than mid-table. I mean, looking at some of those other clubs, you'd maybe think to compete for that. Burnley, I don't think they'll reach the heights of last year, much as I love Burnley. Southampton, we're not going to get anywhere near that. West Ham, I don't think they're going to get anywhere near that. Palace, I don't think you're going to get anywhere near that. Sorry, I don't think Brighton are going to be anything above sort of, you know.
Hey.
Sorry. The other teams you've got are Everton, and I don't think they're that impressive this year. I think they're decent going forward, but they look just as liable to collapse as we do in any kind of game.
Hmm.
Leicester, okay, again, they have their moments, but then they're also terrible in the next game. Watford, you know they're waiting to collapse. I almost feel like they're on the brink of collapsing. And then who have you got left up there? You haven't got that many other teams who you think they're going to be competing for European places. Why can't Bournemouth do it?
They have had a really easy start to the season as well. Like, I think the only top six team they played is Chelsea, and they've had they've hit a lot of teams when they were in bad form. Like, they played West Ham at the start of the season. They played Everton, West Ham, Cardiff, Burnley, who they lost 4-0 against, Leicester at home, Chelsea away, and Watford away. The good results there, like the ones you wouldn't expect them to get, are Watford away, maybe Leicester at home, and maybe a draw against Everton. Really, most of them there are quite expected results. That's the only thing. And they absolutely ship goals in both directions. Like, I just, any team who can actually defend against them, I fancy to get a result. That's the problem with Bournemouth. Is I think if you can go and put together a half-decent defence, which is weird that Watford had done, but they mainly got ripped apart because Cavaselli got sent off, I thought. I think they're a bit overrated.
We're losing 7-0.
Probably, yeah. But I think it's too early to be sort of thinking of them as sort of like European contenders. I think they're likely to end up finishing 10th.
But they're only 2 points behind Tottenham.
Yeah, but they've had, like I said, they've had a really easy start to the season. They've played one hard team. Everybody else they played, they could realistically have... They've started well. There's no doubt about that. But they have had an easy start.
You've got to win the games in front of you. And I'm sure Eddie Howe, he's probably not thinking about European football. He's just thinking to himself, almost halfway to safety, boys.
Yeah, but you compare it to... it's going to sound so biased, but you compare it to our start, where we've played four of the top five. United aren't in the top five. We played United, Tottenham, City and Liverpool, including City and Liverpool away, which are basically no points. You're never going to get points in those. Like... If we just picked up a couple more wins and traded those with Bournemouth, we'd be on similar points to what they are now. I don't think we can really judge where teams are likely to end up finishing now. You know, I still think it's too early. I think we need another 7 or 8 games before we can really see where everyone's shaping up.
I think they're
a good team. They're a good team. There's no doubt about it. But they have had a really easy start. and I'm gonna really hate it when they finish 7th. And I tell you what, if they do, fair play. I'll admit my mistakes. But they have had a nice start.
Well, this is a podcast, so we do like to talk about things. Wolves, though. Wolves have had an almost equally impressive start. It wasn't great. That's just actually a thing. It wasn't great right in the beginning. But they've kind of built on it from there. They're up to 15 points, up to 7th. They're doing pretty damn well, too. Here's my question. Do you think they're going to be anywhere near the relegation battle?
Not sure.
That was the most offensive I've ever heard.
I went from yes, I think they probably will be down there, purely because I think most teams will be. The thing is they've shown more ability to grind out a result than a lot of the teams around them have. They have been more impressive than I probably would have given them credit for at the start of the year. There will be a patch in the season where it will look a bit scary, where they'll go on a few run of games without really scoring. Maybe just after January, when they haven't quite integrated their new signings or something like that yet. I think there might be an edgy moment. But they are a great team. I think they might still be in there. They might still be in with a shout. But they have started well again. They're a different kind of team to Bournemouth as well. They are much more defensively solid.
They've conceded half as many and they've scored about half as many. So it's clearly a very, very different approach to the game. But saying that, you can do the same thing and Bournemouth still have a better goal difference. Maybe it doesn't matter too much how you actually play. Maybe Mourinho is right. But all right, they're talking about... And well, remember a few weeks ago on the podcast, listeners, if you're still with us from there, I was talking about narratives and the difference between Wolves and Cardiff and people saying, oh, Wolves are amazing and they had 2 points and people saying, oh, Cardiff are terrible and they had 2 points. Well, Cardiff are now 20th. They've not won a game. They've lost 6. They're still on 2 points from their 2 draws. I still stick by what I said. Not that Cardiff are good. I've never said that. Don't misinterpret. I simply said that they'd had the exact same start to Wolves and that people had read so many different things into that. But my question for you is, do you think the bottom three as it is now, Cardiff, Newcastle and Huddersfield, is actually going to change?
That was what I said at the start of the season, was Cardiff, Newcastle, Huddersfield. I didn't expect it to take form so quickly. That's the thing. Which
it's not just a case of they don't look like good teams. Obviously, if you've played, 8 games and none of those teams have a win, by the way. Obviously, you're not doing very well. But it's a case of it just looks terrible. It all just, there's nothing positive coming out of it. Even Huddersfield, who were kind of, even last season when they were in the fight for it, still being really positive. Positive come out of it. None of those teams are playing good football. All of their managers are sort of being questioned. Coaching staffs are being questioned. The players, there seems to be some infighting pretty much at all of those clubs. Those are telltale signs of, oh, this isn't just a bad start to the season. This is, we're in trouble. And the thing about it is, I don't know of those three teams, which of them could actually benefit from a new manager bounce. I don't think Huddersfield will sack Wagner. I don't think Newcastle will sack Benitez. And Cardiff couldn't get anyone better.
Sam Allardyce.
Maybe. I don't think he'd honestly go to Cardiff. I think even his powers of saving teams wouldn't work better.
Yeah, it probably
but
wouldn't.
But they couldn't do better than Warnock. Not really. I mean, other than some random unproven foreign manager who maybe could save them just through sheer lack of expectations. But I don't see... It's like with Southampton, I kind of know it's an inevitability. Monkeys won't be with us at the end of the season. Yeah. I think the thing that could save us this year is that we make a sacking probably before January and it sort of turns it around a little bit. I think Fulham as well, they seem a bit brutal. I think they could sack Jukanovic, even though he's been quite good, and I've definitely mispronounced that. You look at all those other teams and you think, yeah, they could probably sack and still get someone.
Yeah.
Those three teams, when you're in that position, that's really the only thing that ever saves you. It doesn't ever turn around internally. It just gets worse. And those are almost the three teams that can't do that. So I don't see how they're going to get themselves out of it, even though I still reckon we're going down.
The thing is when you look at the bottom three, the one that, no offence to Cardiff and Huddersfield, I genuinely can't see a scenario where they stay up. Because, like you said, Huddersfield probably can't get a better manager, more equipped for their team than Wagner is. They probably can't do it. I can't see them being either close enough to it in January to being able to sign a difference maker, which is what they need. They need to find the goals. The only one I can see is if Meunier manages to stay fit and firing, because he has shown at times that he's capable of winning them games, and maybe Aaron Moy as well. But I think for a team that were occasionally score enough goals to win the game, because they were quite forward-thinking and quite attacking, basically they haven't been scoring goals, which means they're just leaking. They're like Bournemouth without the goals, basically. So they're just going to... I find it difficult for them. Cardiff... I think if Cardiff stay up, it will be an absolute miracle. And I would love them to do it in some weird, freakish way, but I just don't think they have a chance. Newcastle, the thing with Newcastle is there is a scenario where they can stay up. If they keep Rafa, which is the biggest, I think, if, because I can imagine him getting to January, and if they were like, yeah, we're still not going to buy anybody, then they'd be like, all right, I'm off. I could see him leaving. But if they manage to buy a few players in January, Rafa is a good enough coach that they will be capable of winning games. I have a reasonable amount of faith in him.
That's the thing about Newcastle, I think, is they're not a bad team. That's a decent group of players. It's not, you know, they're never going to finish Europa League or anything like that with that group of players. That's a good enough team for mid-table. It's a manager who's far better than mid-table. I'd say he's one of the best managers in the world, and I'd say he's proven that several times over.
Yeah,
and they've got one of the biggest stadiums, some of the best fan base. So it's all the right ingredients for almost overachieving, you'd assume.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that club is clearly that the manager knows he's not getting the backing. Players know the manager's not getting the backing. And it's just all negative mentality. The manager can't shout at the players and say, I need you to be doing better. You need to perform better. This isn't good enough. Because he knows how limited it is. He knows these players are trying. And he knows what the environment is. He knows that they know that this is kind of an inevitability, but it's not going to improve. Even if they stay up for another season, they know they're not getting the money. They know they're not getting improved. So they know that there's no real hope for it. So how can you, even if you want to, how can you play at your best if you're like that? But the fans who say, oh, how can a player not play at his best? Think about it at work. When everything's going wrong, when you know your company's going into administration, when everything's screwed, you're not going to be at your best. You're not going to be working at your hardest and best because there's just too much uncertainty. There's no way that human beings, limited creatures that we are, can be at their best in that situation. So as much as people say they haven't played well enough, you know, they've only, I think, what's it, they've conceded 13 goals, which isn't that bad, and they've only scored 6, which I think is about as many as we've scored. But it's that mentality is the biggest thing there. And that can only be broken from the top up. Ashley's got to break that. So that's why I think they're kind of screwed, because we also know Ashley isn't going to break that.
Yeah, exactly. If there was that's basically because they were looking at selling, weren't they, not too long ago?
Yeah.
Ashley was. If that had gone through and that had happened, I could see them making a big statement in January and maybe staying up, because Rafa is their biggest asset. That's the other thing, is like Lou was saying about their squad. Their squad is fine, but most of the teams above them have better squads. The only reason I think they finished 10th last year was because of Rafa. I think he virtually, and because it was so tight and you really, finishing 10th was like 2 points ahead of finishing 16th. I think Rafa is by miles their biggest asset. What do we think? Do we think there are any other teams near the places that are going to get dragged down, or any that we think are going to step back up?
First of all, I'm going to say Southampton. We do not look good. And I've been saying
you look ranked.
We're bad. We're a very, very bad team. I think the only reason we might stay up is that there are enough teams who are worse than us. We concede goals, but not as many as everyone else. And we score just about enough goals in just the right moments to scrap for draws.
Yeah.
So that might be enough to save us. But if other teams improve, we've had it in this group, we're not going to have enough points to actually stay up. We're relying on other teams to be, you know, having less than 35, 34 points.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that'll save us. Fulham, though. Mm. I know some people have said some really nice things about Fulham. They've said, oh, it's a team that plays some really nice football. And yeah, okay, they do kind of play some nice football. But I want to put it another way. People say Brighton play terrible. And
no, they don't. Who says that?
Yes. I have a fan who isn't a Brighton fan.
Oh,
sorry,
no.
Harry.
We play great football.
No, you don't.
Okay, all right.
People say Brighton don't play very good football. And Fulham have scored the same amount of goals as Brighton. And five of those goals have come from Mitrovic. What if he gets injured? He's not a player who's like got proven fitness. He's not one of those players who's fit for the entire season, every single season. He's had issues for and suspensions. And they conceded 21 goals. That's the most in the league. That is a team where if all of a sudden they stop scoring, they're not going to have suddenly stop conceding either. That's a team that could go easily, I think, a run of 5 or 6 games, 0 points, losing 2 or 3 nil at least every time.
Yeah,
they play well, but God, it's so bad in so many ways.
The difficulty with them is they look like they're still working out. Like, they signed a lot of players, and they and like in the last game they changed formation. Like, they went to a 3 at the back, and there's still new players coming to the squad. Like, Morrison hasn't really played, and all this kind of stuff. And they look like they're still trying to work out what to do. And you'd worry if they're still doing that in 4 or 5 games' time that they're going to miss a lot of points they could have got, because they've had a few disappointing results, especially like at home to a few dodgy teams. I actually think Palace are well within a shout of getting dragged down there, and I'm not just saying that because I'm a Brighton fan, but Zaha in the last 2 or 3 games, since he made those comments about being fouled and pulled down and what the players have to do for them to get carded against him, since then he's looked a bit off. He's looked a little bit afraid in a way, and we know how important he is. Because
I think
he's the one in our team you fancy to score a goal at 0-0. Like, he's really the only one who I fancy to do it.
Palace is one of the ones I was going to say, because, right, for one thing, as terrible as we are at scoring, they've scored less goals than us. That's a different level of kind of bad. But the thing about Palace is Roy Hodgson gets them playing some pretty stable football.
Yeah.
They've only conceded 9 goals, and that, if you look at the table, that would actually put them in terms of goals conceded, I think, something like 4th. It's like a ridiculously small amount of goals conceded. So they're solid enough. And you can survive a season if you're not losing every single game, if you're not conceding too many goals. We did it last year. Yes, we did it by the skin of our teeth. It's because we drew enough games. We weren't conceding as many as the guys below us, and that was what saved us. Palace could be in a similar position where they're being saved by the fact their defence is good enough, but their attack clearly, if it hasn't got their one man going for it, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
I think Fulham are, but the difference is I think Fulham are in a much worse position than that. I think Cardiff are pretty much nailed on. I think one of Huddersfield or Newcastle will also definitely be nailed on. So I think Palace will be okay, because the other team will be either Huddersfield, Fulham or Southampton, possibly maybe West Ham if they suddenly forget how to play football again. Because West Ham do that for some reason. They go, right, we can play amazing football and we're super, super good. And then, what was this football game? I thought we were supposed to pick it up and throw it. They just forget. They forget in a moment. I don't understand West Ham. Genuinely don't. How can a team be that good and that bad at the same time?
To be fair, it's really interesting talking to quite a lot of people, particularly West Ham fans, about, because we played them on the weekend and we won 1-0. Go us. New England centre-back Lewis Dunk had a good game. But I was at the game, and it's really interesting because most people who I spoke to who are West Ham fans thought they didn't play very well. They very, very easily could have drawn that game, very easily. I would say we were not so much lucky to win it, but we rode our luck at times. Like, Arnautovic missed one from 2 or 3 yards. There was one that bounced over the bar, all of this kind of stuff. Like, there was a few little chances that very easily could have gone in. We probably could have scored maybe one more ourselves, but, you know, I still think they were fine in that game. And the teams I always worry about are the ones that that lose to the teams around them in games when they shouldn't. Those are and that's the problem with Fulham, is Fulham are losing to the teams around them or dropping points against the teams around them. Like, with the exception of drawing away with us, they dropped 2 points in that game, and it's more than 2 points really, because it would have been one less point for us. It's really dropping 3 points. And the teams like Huddersfield and Cardiff, you know, they need a miracle really to pull them through the next few games and get them firing or whatever. But like, I can fancy Newcastle to grind out results against the teams around them. I worry about whether Fulham can do that, is the difficulty. I worry that they'll stick too hard to their philosophy of attacking football, that they'll maybe win a couple of extra games because of it, but they'll probably lose some games they could have drawn. And those points are massive when you're fighting for relegation of the teams around you.
I think West Ham are actually in a bit of a similar category, because they've so far seemed to perform well against the bigger teams, but not against the teams that are around them. And that is exactly what we did in the first season we were back up. Performed amazingly against the big teams, and then we were just losing every single week against the bad teams. It's what got Adkins sacked, and we brought in Pochettino, obviously we now have that one to help. But that season could have easily have carried on that way, and we'd have gone back down. The two sets of fans I would feel horrendously sorry for if they did go down would be Newcastle fans, who don't deserve that. They do not deserve that at all. And West Ham fans, I know a lot of people don't like West Ham fans, but put yourselves in the supporters' positions. They have been dragged through the ringer, the absolute ringer, and they have not had a proper go of it. The new stadium, all these kinds of things. Be very harsh on those sets of fans, especially because they're such passionate and big fan bases. Like, I hate to say it, but nobody would feel too bad if Bournemouth went down. You know, they're good supporters all of that lot. 20,000 of them. West Ham, it's just so much bigger at Newcastle, and you know, it's so much more of an important part of the entire culture of the area. Like Newcastle, the city itself runs on football.
Yeah,
it's not just it's the football side of things. It's just endemic in the city. I'd feel so very bad if Newcastle went down this year. They deserve better than that as a club. Those fans deserve a hell of a lot better. But I think that is going to be it for this week's podcast. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening to our show. In terms of some of the upcoming things, I know I've been mentioning that we've got a few debates coming up, and we do have those coming up. We're just waiting until we get enough people on to make it a probably good debate for you. We've also got all the other shows, as I mentioned. We've got the wrestling podcast with Nick Davey and Chris Lavin on there. You've also got us on the F1 podcast, Anthony Kendrick, who's a regular on this. Please go and check out all of those. And thank you very much for joining me this week, and good night.